Thank you very much, Aaron, and thank you all for inviting me. It's a little bit daunting and humbling, really, to be in the midst of such an august audience, because I really do regard this audience as august, because you are studying something that's very deep and profound, which is going beyond the usual human dimension. And I suppose that is daunting to speak to that, because I'm not a mystic, I'm not a sage. far from it. I suppose the words that came to mind was that I suppose I might be a bridge to something for people who don't have any access to bridges in the West, and that's somewhat of a role maybe I've played a little bit. Not that I know much about the territory that people are bridging to. But that said about me, I thought that this evening it would be interesting, and I'm not sure that I have anything to say on the subject of the title. I think it's a great title myself. I sort of thought of it for a while. I said, gosh, that's a daunting title. And I thought, maybe that can be just a koan for us all to contemplate a little. So having said that, I think that I thought that what I would do this evening is introduce a little bit of the Buddhist notion, but with a Western psychological background to the Buddhist notion, the Buddhist understanding of the Buddhist path in brief. And I know that we've got about, and I'm going to take off my watch because I think we've got about an hour and a quarter. Yeah. So I might speak for about 30, 40 minutes, and then we could open it up for discussion. A little introduction to the Buddhist path, I suppose, as a way to the inner being, or to the inner self, or inward. And perhaps, I suppose, that's an interesting place to start, because I was driving over the hills with Anthony earlier on, from Samiling, and I mean, Anthony used the word esoteric, and I just thought, yeah. I was sort of planning to say a little bit about that. And it does seem as though, you know, in various traditions, that were kept really quite secret in previous generations, that there has been an opportunity in our age for the esoteric to open its door more open and invite people into that to that way of understanding. And I'm sort of doing that because I suppose also it's everything is double-edged, isn't it? Because, well, first of all, I think we have entered a stage where esoteric spirituality, if you like, has become the order of the day rather than anything else. And I think Ken Wilber was one of the people who said that first, that I saw it, and I said, yeah, that seems to be right, that the exoteric traditions seem to be falling away. Certainly in Ireland, Catholicism and Christianity in its outer form has fallen further and further away and has less influence in an overt way. Yet I think people are still searching for something that's perhaps to do with the inner. But of course the inner and the esoteric, or even indeed you can call it the occult, which just simply means the hidden, is certainly in Buddhism we talk about it as self-hidden. It's not there to be revealed just necessarily, just that you want it or you stumble onto the word. But it's something deeper and more profound. And I suppose then I wanted to talk more in that frame, really, rather than some outer frame. And maybe, for me, I think the image that came to mind for this evening's talk was the image of the mandala. And I suppose part of my journey started with mandalas. And I suppose it was Carl Jung who pointed out that the mandala is a symbol of the self, the true self, the higher self, if you like. And I've always liked that sense of the mandala as an image of the true self, but also an image of the path to the true self. And in a sense, the mandala then as the, in the center of the mandala being the end of the journey, and the outer periphery of the mandala being the start of the journey. And it has struck me that it's a useful metaphor, and I'm looking at what I see on the wall there, which has that quality. And that quality, I suppose, is that maybe there are many paths from the periphery to the center, but there is only one center. You might call the center different things, but there is still only one center. And I suppose what struck me over years of studying in this area is that I've often said that it feels to me as though that the mystics of all of the traditions, be that Sufi, Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, whatever, are probably closer to each other than the people on the periphery. And that makes sense because they're closer to the center. So in a way, I suppose, then I offer this talk a little bit on Buddhism in that spirit, the spirit that really it's all the same path, but there's different words and different understandings. And I suppose it was Jung that also introduced me to the idea first that in that inner journey that there are maps, if you like. There are people who've gone before and who've laid out maps. But that also as you progress through the different layers of that journey, as you go through the different layers of the outer, going more towards the inner, that there are transition points to be crossed. And there are struggles to be had. And of course, I suppose in a way, those struggles are really only in the end with ourselves. But still, those struggles are there. And you know, it's a subtext of some of the conversations I was having both with Anthony and a little with Aaron, and with yourself, the head of the school, is the whole idea that we are in a situation where we, there's a fascination in the world with the brain at the moment, and with training the brain and brain training. And that in a sense, I suppose, the inner traditions are more about training the heart, and about the heart of the matter, and about training the heart, and in a sense are coming to our true heart, if you like. And when I think about that, I have to get very humble, because you know, if you examine your heart deeply enough, maybe you can really find how serious a person one really is. I think I'm a dilettante masquerading as serious. So maybe to give a flavor of the Buddhist path, I would say a few words maybe about the Buddhist path. And I was thinking I might cover three fours. I mean, the Buddhists sometimes like numbers. They're not obsessed by numbers, but it seems like a lot of things come in fours anyway. And one of the four things that we have is the four foundations, or the four ordinary. They're called the four ordinary foundations. But of course, they're also extraordinary, because everything is both. And the four ordinary foundations we discuss or talk about in Buddhism is the idea of an understanding of impermanence. And the second is an understanding of, if you like, the laws of the universe, the natural laws of the universe, which some people might call cause and effect, the laws of cause and effect. Sometimes I think perhaps badly understood as karma, which is, you know, is a word that came sort of floating from the East when people poorly understood what was being talked about in the East. Karma rather as some sort of sense of destiny rather than the real word, which means action. It actually means action. It means the action of the mind or the body or the heart. And in that sense, it's cause and effect. And then the truth of suffering. And we don't have to say too much about that one, I think, nowadays. then the truth of the preciousness of human life. That's the fourth one, that there is something very profound and very precious about our existence and about our lives. That we can choose to follow the preciousness or not, but that there are precious opportunities. But going back to impermanence for a few moments, because I think impermanence is critical to the Buddhist path, and it's, you know, I remember a friend of mine, you know, saying to him in the pub one evening, I said, this was about the, particularly the financial crisis, but particularly about the Irish financial crisis. And he was right in the thick of it, up to about here, you know, sort of a financial investor, an accountant, a serious man of money. And I turned around to him and I said, Connor, but it was going to end. And he looked at me. And he was actually, I think he was quite insulted, because he thought that I was telling him that I had some insider knowledge that I didn't share with him so that he could get his money out in time. And I had to really explain to him that I wasn't talking about that, that I was just talking about the notion of impermanence and that people, that things don't continue the way that. But we have a lot of hard time really understanding that. And you know, Buddhism goes quite a lot into that subject and into the, as opposed to the nature of reality as not being that, you know, if we take the table, for example, I mean, I think the Buddha used a cart, but if you use the table, that the table is really a, even the table is really just a psychological construct. It's a construct itself. I mean, when does the table stop being a table? When you take away its legs? Well, or, you know, if it's in the Amazonian jungle, maybe it's a raft, you know, and a person would turn it upside down and use it to raft on the Amazon. So it has a very relative being or very relative existence. And so everything has this, I suppose, what Einstein defined as relativity, that everything is relative, highly relative, and very non-solid and very fluid and shaky and moving. In Buddhism, that of course is seen as both. It is the metaphor, the symbol of the river that we cross from suffering to nirvana, to peace, or the great ocean of suffering, as it's sometimes referred. And it's of that reality. Again, coming over in the car, I think Anthony referred to it as the immanent or the manifest, which is ephemeral, if you like. And of course, there's great opportunity, because it is what you cross to get to the other side. But it's also the thing that has the storms and can be destructive and can prevent the crossing. So in Buddhism, then, we would work with this. We work with change and work with, and of course, for those who are psychotherapists in the audience, we all know, and I've heard this a few, is, you know, that we know that an awful lot of what we do in the work we do is working with people around change, be it death, loss, or whatever, you know, that ability to handle change and flux. And of course, in a way, I mean, the Buddha went to the heart of that when he said that, you know, that attachment is our problem. And we get attached inner, we get attached to our thoughts and to our emotions, to our sense of self. We want to fix things, and we want to, it's like, you know, it's like getting a glass slide and getting a piece of nature and putting it on a glass slide and fixing it so that it's nice and fixed, and then everything's fine, it's fixed. I mean, in my business, we talk about a fix. You know, people get fixed with heroin, you know, you're fixed. So that idea that we want to fix things and we want to know, how much flux or impermanence can we live with? So that's one dimension. And of course, out of that, we've got a 17-year-old at home, and he just came in the other day and said, "Brian, I've got these things. We've got to watch these. These are okay. They're all right. They're not too violent. And I think you and I could watch them together, because I won't watch any violence with them, or, you know, I prefer PG, parental guidance, or universal." It's my level of preference. So this was Back to the Future. It was the trilogy of Back to the Future, that 80s set of movies. But actually, it's a wonderful rendition of cause and effect, you know, and, you know, the chap who's got the time machine, you know, he says, you know, when you go back or you go forward, you're not allowed to look at yourself or look at anything or disturb anything, because you could disturb the future. It's fascinating. It's really a good example of cause and effect. And they also, in that series of movies, they create different realities depending on small, tiny little changes. You know, it's quite fascinating. It's a really good rendition. Spielberg does a beautiful job of it. He really does. Of what that might be about. And I suppose, in a way, I mean, you know, it's... And this is something I just go... Sometimes I have to acknowledge my frustration as a scientist. Because we were also talking a little bit about science. And I know you've had some talks about science. And I mean, that definition, I think it was... That gentleman, Colin Touch, was talking about, you know, that religion is a paradigm that encompasses everything and explains everything. And I mean, science is in a way, I mean, it is actually, I think science has got to the point where it's a religion. Really. And, you know, if you can be a heretic now in science. Lots of heretics. And maybe we're in the heretic class here. But, you know, so heresy is that, you know, like they've even got the God spot, haven't they? They can explain, you know, the experience of God by some sort of part of your brain, you know. So there you are, it's all explained. So they can explain everything. But I suppose what I go knock, knock is it seems as though that science has... confined itself to what we would call the substantial, or to the manifest. So it's the science of the manifest or the substantial. You have to be able to feel, taste, touch it. It has to, you know, it almost has to have monetary value, you know, because that's actually the symbol we use for money as well, isn't it? So it's material, matter, it matters. And of course, what I go knock knock about is that it doesn't appear as though science has ever considered really seriously that, you know, that this might also apply to the mind, to the area of the mind and to the area of our experience, and that cause and effect may be equally relevant there. Okay, there's been some sort of minor nod in that direction. I mean, Freud, you know, and so on, and the development and to our early life development and how that might affect who we are in the present. But it's a nodding acknowledgement. It's not a deep acknowledgement. Whereas in, I think in Buddhism they would go as far as, and I mean this is beyond, I'm not a serious meditator, I'm not a mystic, but you know, I mean even very subtle levels of mind movement can cause all sorts of ramifications for our lives and for our being. So it's quite, these are subtle and profound levels. And it would appear as though that modern Western science has no place for that at all. But there is the inklings of change. I'm smiling slightly because I was at a talk. I was talking to a professor in Trinity College in Dublin the other day. We met for a meeting about research, and he's trying to research the brains of people as they function, as they watching the brain. He's got one of these amazing fMRIs where you can watch the brain function, and he's trying to recruit heroin users to see what their brains are like. And of course I could hear in the conversation that we were getting to the point where we might actually begin to teach morality within science, because people would begin to see that the way that their brains worked, that the way that they functioned emotionally and in thought had implications for their lives. And so I think that's beginning to emerge. There's more subtle, there's an opening, a possibility that science is going to open itself to that area, but it's very preliminary. So we may not get much beyond the four foundations this evening. So the next is suffering, and in Buddhism we talk about different layers of suffering. I mean, there's what we call suffering, the suffering of change, and what we call inevitable suffering. And suffering is the sort of stuff that, you know, it's like, you know, you get out of bed in the morning and you stub your toe, and then you fall over at the same time and bash your head, and you're suffering. You know, it's that sort of thing. One thing leads to another, and or you've had too much to drink the night before, and you say, why did I do that again? And that sort of suffering. Whereas the suffering of change is more that idea of, we were talking about the impermanence, and that idea that things are changing, and just the, you know, I don't know why this comes to mind, but I'll use the example. I mean, my parents, my father died a couple of years ago at 96, and my mother is still in her 80s, and there was quite a gap, and they lived a very successful life together as a couple, I would say, you know, successful in the sense of happiness. But yet, you know, that it has an end, you know, that it has to end, and that, you know, and that even the good things in life, even the best things in life, have a moment of ending. And even if that's profoundly beautiful or whatever, it still has an ending, and therefore there is a suffering connected to that somehow. And then inevitable suffering is more just the suffering of being a human, for instance. Just, you know, the fact we get older, or the fact that that's changed. But it's more just like the process of maintaining human existence in its more basic form, you know, whether that's having to wash and shave or whatever, and all the little sufferings of life. Or maybe it's even more subtle and more profound. It may be even just seeing suffering, or seeing life, or being aware. Just awareness itself may be suffering at that more subtle level. Then the preciousness. And I suppose the preciousness then is about, really, it's more connected to the opportunity for path. That there is a path beyond that. That there is hope beyond the mundane and the ordinary. And beyond, and again, like I think often in Eastern religions, there's sort of a misunderstanding that it's predestined or predestiny, rather than the idea that it's opportunity, that karma is opportunity, that action is opportunity. So it's more like the idea of opportunity. So the Buddha taught the four noble truths, and the first of those was suffering again, that we suffer, and that suffering is inherent to the condition of being, if you like, that whether, you know, you're animal or human, or perhaps you can dissect other levels of existence, more godlike existence, is not God now, it's not the, but, you know, or more hellish existences, and within that frame of all those, that they are effectively realms of suffering, beyond transcendence, that until we transcend them, they are suffering. Then a second truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. And in here, I think, is the, you get into the more subtle analysis, which people are probably familiar with, but we can open it up for discussion, which is that it's not just the, so we talked about attachment, but even below attachment, there is a sense of ignorance. And it's interesting because different schools of Buddhism define those two areas slightly differently, or look at those areas, or emphasize those areas slightly differently, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But is the... So attachment, I sometimes feel it's like, you know, one of those water wheels that goes round and round, you know, the cycle of existence. And the attachment is, you know, we're strapped to the outside of it. And around it goes, and, you know, we suffer and suffer. And while we stay attached, we suffer. And when we can get unattached, we maybe can get inside the wheel, you know, which is actually, again, the mandala sort of example, going inner rather than outer. So I suppose then that he taught that there's a cause, but he also taught that it's attachment to the outer, but it's also attachment to the inner, and it's attachment to the inner particularly in the sense of a self, or a solid sense of self, or a self that is separating us from the true inner, if you like, the deep inner, if you will. And that's actually where I think the slight difference or nuance is, because I think that to some extent, it's not, this isn't true, it's a caricature, but it's for the purposes of just description, I can use a caricature, which is that Southern Buddhism, which is more the Theravada tradition, where you see the yellow robe monks in Burma, Sri Lanka, Southern India, that group, seem to emphasize more the attachment and the idea of, again, Anthony and I were talking about this in the car, more that sense of detachment from, as a counter to attachment. Whereas in Northern schools of Buddhism, which would be the Mahayana schools, which includes the Chan that became the Zen as it moved across into Japan and up into the Himalaya, which also became Vajrayana, which is what I'm connected with, they emphasize more, I would say, the idea of ignorance, the ignoring. But the ignorance, the true ignorance, is the ignorance of the true inner, whatever you call it. It doesn't matter whether you call it Buddha nature or God or whatever. It seems as though it's shared within all the traditions as the inner essence of who we are. I mean, in Buddhism, they call it the Dharmakaya at its ultimate level. And it has its manifestation through the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. The Nirmanakaya is the manifest, and the Sambhogakaya is the connector. So, in a sense, then he taught that's the cause, and then the path is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path, but also the truth of cessation. So before path you have cessation, and cessation is the idea that you can go beyond, that one can go beyond the cycle of existence, the wheel of existence, that one can get to the center of that wheel, and that one can transcend. But also I think in a way it's in the sense, transcendent is in the sense, again we were talking in the car about this, non-attachment. It's not necessarily detachment, although one can detach for periods, like many of the hermits of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition would have gone to the mountains for years, 8 years, 16 years. Not uncommon to have them, you know, again, seems to be numbers of four, but but anyway, but they go there for a while, but then they come back, and it's that idea of non-attachment. And of course, the whole business, I mean, you know, I suppose in this business, I mean, I have to think of another slight small koan. You know, it's like, sometimes it's described as an Irish joke. I've seen it described as an Irish joke, but I'm sure it's not. But you know, of the two Americans that are looking for Killarney, and they meet the guy on the side of the road with a straw in his mouth. And and they say to him, you know, can you tell us the way to Killarney? And, you know, the Irish guy sort of says, and after a few minutes of thought, he says, if I were you, sir, he says, I wouldn't start from here. And I suppose that's unfortunately where we're starting. You know, so what's this non-attachment to non-attachment? How can you be unattached to not being attached, and so on and so on, and these koans. So I suppose in a way that's sort of related to the title, but also I think it has another problematic, because if the true self is not the self in its ordinary mundane sense, you know, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to grasp at that which is not the self, or how does the self which isn't the self, the higher self, how does it guide the self that doesn't understand it's not the self, and so on we go around. But at a more deeper level, I suppose, these are taught in Buddhism as layers of awareness and of teaching of awareness. And I suppose the path, in a way, the Buddhist path, is very much connected to meditation, which is meditation in awareness, which is, if you like, I suppose meditation is certainly in its lower forms, in its more, you know, where you start for years, and I'm talking about years of on the foothills of meditation, in that sense of lower forms, not lower in the sense of what we need, because it's what you need. You have to start where you are, after all. So in starting where you are, beginning where you are, that other cone. So we begin from where we are, or who we are. So from that point, we have to start and work on less subtle levels. But meditation is seen as core to the path. In Mahayana Buddhism, I'll stop in a few minutes for discussion. But in Mahayana Buddhism, we talk a little bit about also. Maybe it's useful to introduce something else, which is that they talk about the path as having six main aspects, of which meditation is one of them. And I'm doing that because I always think of them in a hierarchical form. And they're sometimes taught like that. And they're taught as the foot of it is described as generosity, whatever that might mean in its totality. Obviously, it's generosity of spirit, but it's also generosity of material substances, and it's so on. And the second is called is to do with right conduct, skillful use of conduct. I sent an email the other day, and I had to say to the person after I'd sent it, after we'd had a couple of communications about it, that it was an unskillful email. You know, it was genuinely unskillful. We sometimes do that. We lack the skill, like the archer's skill to hit the bullseye. So conduct seems to be important. The next is patience. And I think patience has, you know, again, very ordinary and very profound levels of understanding. It can be patience with our neighbor, our friend, our irritant. Patience particularly with ourselves, of course. And, of course, I'm somehow just for a moment reminded of therapy, you know, and that, you know, sometimes the interjection or the inner parent that is impatient. So we're impatient with ourselves because our parent was impatient, our mother or our father were impatient with us, so they were patient with us, and how we internalize those qualities. So it's that. So these parameters, in a way, go to the depth of our, perhaps, the personality, the development of the personality, the path, the personality as path. And then, and of course, with all the things that go with the personality, the emotions and so forth, and patience, I suppose, particularly is connected to that area, the emotional area. Which is an area that I work in quite a bit, I think, in the Buddhist area, in the Buddhist world. I'm more. And then the next one up is energy, or they sometimes call it joyful effort or energy, joyful energy. You know, it's the application of a joyful life, if you like. It's that sense of joyousness. And if we're not generating joy, then we ain't at the races at all. We're somewhere else. Because somehow the inner is about joy. You can't get to the inner without something about joy. But they also talk in Buddhism about transcending joy, you know, that, and certainly its grosser forms, which is something that I might know in theory, but not in practice. And then meditation, as moving into a more subtle and a more elaborated, it's more difficult to master meditation than it is to master generosity. And then finally, wisdom. But of course, I never can really mention wisdom without mentioning compassion, because somehow in there, in the core essence of the Mahayana path, is compassion. And without the heart of compassion, without the depth of compassion, those other what are sometimes called the paramitas, and it means para means other, and para, you know, para professional, parachute, other paramita, other shore. So they're the manifestation of what it would be like if we were Buddha, or if we were Christ, or if we were the enlightened sage, that we would manifest these qualities. I always love that piece. I'm always attracted to that, because being a goal oriented Westerner, I want to know something about where I'm going, about the other shore, about some sort of sense of the other shore. So in a sense then, I think, in essence, I suppose, without the heart of compassion, my teacher, Akin Rinpoche, would say that all the rest of it is very dry. It's sort of dry desert, that the oasis that we were talking about is only manifest through compassion, which is compassion for ourselves and others. And then in Buddhism, I think for that reason, they emphasize a lot. And in fact, I know there's a weekend going on at Semiling this weekend on mindfulness, but also on compassion. And in the Tara Rupa work, we sort of bring people through stages of therapy that are somewhat similar to Western psychotherapy, but then bring people more in the direction of compassion, more in the direction of the heart, more in the direction of, as I say, the paramitas, more in the direction of working with the personality, the personhood, refining, so it becomes more a path rather than just a therapy. I suppose I'll just make one final mention of something, and that is that I was going to mention four others, and they're the special foundations that I won't really go into them. They're special Buddhist meditation practices that are quite, you know, they're about mantra and about prostration and about offering. And I suppose at the end of that, the fourth one is about the teacher, about the connection with the teacher. It's interesting in the West, actually. I'm sort of slightly amused, because I was having a conversation last week about idolatry. And as a former Catholic converted Protestant before becoming a Buddhist, I've sort of experienced that from different domains and dimensions. And sometimes I think, you know, when people see the guru in Buddhism, they think about it as idolatry, you know, as a type of idolatry. I think we sort of see it through that lens. And in fact, I was having the conversation in Berlin with a friend of mine who's a Buddhist, but has brought up a good staunch Protestant down in Bavaria somewhere. But he, you know, and we know each other a very long time, and there is a thing called devotion to the teacher, and he was sort of making allusion to a third party in the room, and he was saying, well, of course, that my devotion was more florid. And I didn't quite fully understand what he meant, you know, although I did. And then it was, of course, it was the Catholic background that meant it was more florid. So it's more sort of maybe just demonstrative. But of course there is the skeptic or the cynic in there as well. And, you know, it's not that we, and I think this idea of idolatry, it's quite an interesting topic, that actually. You could say that everything is idolatry until we hit the Godhead or the true self or the inner whatever, you know, that you're idealizing something beyond what it should be. And I think sometimes the teacher may be misunderstood in Buddhism a bit like that. And of course, Westerners, in Trungpa Rinpoche, who actually also co-founded Semiling, used to talk about, you know, Westerners were fundamentally theistic. But I think he meant in the sense of idolatry, that we we tend to over-idolize something to the point of actually missing the point of it. So it's that missing the point. So the point really about the teacher is not to idolize the teacher, rather to truly learn, to be, have the capacity to learn from the teacher, which demands a certain degree of humility. I don't know how much humility it demands. I haven't really gone there. So I suppose that's part of particularly Vajrayana Buddhism. I think it would be, you know, just to mention that. But so the teacher sort of is an outer representative of the capacity, your inner, own inner capacity, to come to understand your true self, your deeper being. And that's all they are, and they're only that, and they're dispensable, if you like, in the ultimate sense. But of course, it's like a good parent, you know, an elderly parent. You would look after them, of course, like you would your parent. It's interesting that I've ended up in the later part of my career. I was a general psychiatrist. I was a psychotherapist before that in psychiatry, and finally ended up in addiction. It's interesting. Because I suppose Buddha had a lot to say about addiction, about attachment. And I suppose in what we were just talking about, I mean, addiction is fundamentally a type of idolatry, isn't it? It's the idealization of the outer. You know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, I'm a coffee addict or whatever. I feel I have to have my cappuccino in the morning. Or the day won't go right. But of course that gets to a point where the addiction, you know, becomes profoundly disabling of a personhood. And again, I suppose the analysis, I mean, I'd like to link this analysis, you know, because also I like to think of addiction in terms of at least five dimensions, which would be the biological, the psychological, the sociological, the anthropological, and the spiritual. You know, that it's at least across those domains. It's across the domain, all of the domains you can think of what is to be a human, in a sense. And in a way, it's a very human thing as well. It seems to be very human. You know, the alcoholic on the street corner who can't really afford a bed because all of his money has to go on his alcohol. There's something very human about that in a certain way as well. And of course, you know, it's interesting because we work in Buddhism, we work with the elements, and it's like fire, you know, it's like a fire that destroys everything. It burns the television set, it consumes the table, the house the person has, and so forth. But across that dimension, I suppose, I mean, and I also would have to see it in terms of the dimension of the developmental dimension of the human being. And of course, I think you get transects all the time in those dimensions, so that anthropological analysis would look at our cities and our modern lifestyles. And I mean, I know in Dublin and in Edinburgh and in Glasgow, you know, what do you see? You see this huge opiate dependence in certain strata of society. And how is that? That's hugely anthropological and sociological in its nature. And you know, I regard the modern world as highly arrogant, and we're, you know, going back to that knock knock, it's like, you know, the ignorance is profound in our modern science, you know, about like that we can just move swathes of human beings into large megapolises, and they can live in almost any circumstance, and that doesn't affect their lives and who they are and so forth. Take that side of it. It reminds me of a story. I mean, I'll just tell this story because it's always the story that comes to mind when I think of that analysis. I remember in Nairobi, in the game park in Nairobi, they were having huge problems with these marauding young male elephants. And they tried everything. They couldn't solve it. And finally, what they did is they actually brought them back into the main herd and attached them to the main herd, and it all got sorted. And that, to my mind, was an anthropological intervention. And in a sense, if you look at it, I just look around our cities now, and I look at all these young people going out partying on their own, going, dropping ecstasy or God knows what. I mean, the number of substances is increasing exponentially. You know, the chemists are designing, we're going to ban 170 in Ireland next in June, but by the time we've got those banned, they'll have another 170 on the, you know, the stockpiles. And then that idea that young people can be that abstracted within our societies. So that layer. Then, of course, the layer that happens when people are growing, and even what happens to what we now know as the hardwiring of the brain, the way the brain is hardwired. You know, that I can see a child at 5 and 7 and know that they're already primed for addiction because they have no rewards in their lives. Their parents are able to understand how to reward the child and to give the child fulfillment. And I suppose what we're beginning, and I suppose the psychiatric dimension to this, is that we're beginning to understand the brain chemistry, the neuroscience of that. You know, when I was saying to Anthony in the car on the way over, I give a lecture in University College Dublin on the subject, you know, addiction, don't even think about it. Because by the time you've thought of your favourite addictive pastime, you're already halfway, your brain is already halfway to a relapse. You know, because you're priming, you're already priming, and your chemistry is already anticipating, whether it's cocaine or sex or, you know, the latte or whatever it is that you're thinking about. So in a sense, I suppose that and I suppose that you know, there's again what I would say, Aaron, is that we're moving, you know, there's the subtle and then there's the gross. And I suppose addiction is a pretty gross mirror for looking at what's happening to most of us all the time, really. We're in these cycles. And in a sense, I suppose, we, you know, if you look at it from a brain point of view, I remember this Holiness Dalai Lama at one of these neuroscience conferences there some time ago, and he was saying, you know, that most of what we experience is what in Buddhism we call the negative emotions, like, you know, lust, envy, greed, you know, rage, is very gross. There's a gross brain correlate, you know, that by the time, you know, it's sort of, I see it as a cascade, you know, it's like, you know, by the time you've thought about the thing and it starts cascading down, it sort of, it manifests and becomes, it's a bit like a rock going over a hill. It sort of, it has an inevitable momentum of its own and consequences, which is cause and effect. It's interesting, I often think about sort of places like this, you know, that are up on the top of a mountain in a bowl, you know, it's like you're in a place where you may be able to go beyond that, you know, to the inner, which is beyond. So I think in a way, but it's interesting, you know, that I think also in the West, we were talking about this today, you know, I was on the car on the way over, like Akin Rinpoche in Sami Ling, you know, people go there to meditate and he puts them out in the buildings. Gives us work to do, because in a way it's like as though that's what you might call more gross mindfulness, because you're not capable of more subtle levels of mindfulness. And in a sense, for addiction, I think that in the early stages of the addictive cycle, where we try and help people break the addictive cycle, we don't work with the subtle, we work with the more gross levels, you know, work, bringing them back into ordinary situations and so forth. But also sociology is vital to recovery, because you have to create social, like it's almost like, I sometimes feel it's a bit like, you know, smuggling people out of you know, totalitarian state. You have to give them another identity, another place to live. You know, they have to create a whole different life. So I don't know, I mean, I could speak for hours about addiction, but that would be an initial response. But I think, of course, the key link is the attachment and the sense that, and of course the inner attachment and the outer attachment and the sense in which people get attached to, and I suppose what's really, you know, I think what's really, I suppose sad, you know, in a way, about addiction. I mean, I deal with a lot of, I deal with the hard end of addiction, you know, heroin addiction, all that thing. And I look at the people who come to our clinics and to our centres and so forth, and I often feel how, I suppose, the word that comes to mind is pathetic, as in the sense of pathos, because actually they're not coping. They don't cope well. They can't cope well. Doesn't mean they don't have the capacity. But I think what's sad is that sometimes they lose the belief or the ability to have any sense of hope that they could break the pattern. And often with addiction, that's the really profound thing about addiction, is that, you know, I sometimes see it like the rabbit snare, you know, that every time the rabbit tries to pull, that the snare gets tighter. You know, and that when we talk about the, you know, chasing the dragon, and then when the dragon gets you, finally, you know, and you're got, that escape is difficult. And in fact, often, you know, that what I see, you know, mostly is that it's these flailing attempts at overcoming it, rather than, you know, a really profound thought through journey, you know, that needs to be undertaken for those who've really got caught deeply. But of course, there's lots of good stories too. Lots of people make it. Even we even stop smoking cigarettes sometimes. Or these things are possible. I sometimes think the stars have to be right for it. Trungpa used to say that the Buddhist path was about becoming human, about the ability to become truly human, and that the end of the path was to become a human, and that was it. The Buddha achieved enlightenment, and he walked around and travelled for 40 years in India as a teacher, but he was human, highly human. And I suppose I mean it in a lot of different ways, because in the Buddhist analysis, it's only when we have finally let go totally and utterly and completely of the final and most subtle levels of attachment that we actually achieve enlightenment, to become fully human, actually, probably. But until then, we are in the throes of various levels of delusion. And maybe that's what I meant about being human. It's sort of that idea of, well, he's just a little bit more obviously deluded than the most of the rest of us are. And, I mean, maybe I could give an example that comes to mind, you know, of where it appears as though that, you know, it's more enlightened addiction than the bottle. But, you know, in Ireland, you know, and I'm sorry to use the example of our recent Prime Minister Bertie, but Bertie was sort of quite well loved by people. And in fact, I like him as a person. And but, you know, we seem to have been in the throes in Ireland, at his leadership for about 10 years, in the throes of a delusion, you know, and now we're left with about double the capacity of housing that we need for the whole country, virtually. Not quite, but I'm slightly exaggerating, but it's not far off that. And you've now got a situation where, you know, property prices have dropped dramatically, and where, you know, where people aren't going to be able to rent even a lot of the space they've got. And they're being charged by the government for having a second home, and they're going to have to pay tax on it. And you get into these negative, negative, negative spirals. And I suppose that, I mean, I do mean attachment in that sense of, you know, almost like what I call, we have a certain level of grandiosity. You know, that we, you know, and the more power you get, it seems the more grandiose one can become. And of course, but also, you see, it's interesting, because the more power you get, and your faults and failings may manifest more grossly. Like poor old Bertie, he's only an ordinary fellow who likes his pint of, I think he likes Bass or something, it's not even an Irish beer. but you know what I mean, so that it has more profound effects. But it's, You know, I suppose we might call it hubris is another name, you know, the sort of sense of hubris and pride and, you know, I mean, and I suppose I'd be very conscious in a talk like this as somebody who knows nothing about what I'm fundamentally talking about at its deeper spiritual level, you know, not being a mystic, not being somebody, how can I even have the audacity to talk on these subjects? You know, and that sort of thing, and also, you know, leading people astray, and that sort of sense of delusion. So, and I suppose, you know, I suppose in a way, as a psychiatrist, you know that very bad joke about, you know, what's the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychotic? And a neurotic, you know, what's the difference between a psychiatrist, a neurotic, and a psychotic? And, you know, the neurotic builds castles in the air, the psychotic lives in them, and and the psychiatrist collects the rent. So anyway, you know, I sort of try and keep my feet on the ground enough to collect the rent, but I think a lot of the time I live in it or start building it, you know, so I'm all those bits, I think. So I think in that sense, and in a way, you know, the alcoholic in a way, and very often, you know, the alcoholic will say it's all dust anyway, you know, or it's, you know, sometimes they can have a profound insight, you know, and have less to lose, you know. So I think it's in that sense. One other point about that, maybe just being a specialist in psychosis, I'm saying a little bit more serious about that, is that there's a guy called Podvil, Edward Podvil. He's a psychiatrist, he's a Buddhist psychiatrist. He wrote a couple of books and set up a project in the States. And his book is called The Seduction of Madness, that idea that we can be seduced into madness so that it's a choice. But I suppose also this idea that we have an illusion that we can discern reality from illusion. But we actually can't. We're not wired that way. And all we can actually know is that we may have a suspicion that we're caught in illusion. And sometimes, you know, actually, that, I don't know why, I just seem to be a lot reminded of Trungpa Rinpoche this evening, but is that, you know, he used to call, sometimes he's called the Buddhist path the path of disappointment. In other words, one more illusion gone. Disillusioning. And I suppose a sub-interest, if I had nothing else to do, I suppose I'm fascinated by the way the mind, it's like as though the brain is wired to create, you know, it's like as though, you know, these second lives they have now, and you've got avatars in your second life. I mean, I hate the thing, but I watch the 17-year-old sometimes doing this thing, you know, with these avatars. And, but in a way it's almost like that actually we are our own avatars. We're living in a virtual reality, and that the brain is wired to create that, and then we live in it, and then we misunderstand that for the real all the time. And in that sense, I suppose that it is, you know, it's just layers of psychosis. I mean, in Buddhism, actually, another thing they say, and this is why I know I'm still psychotic, is that they say, you know, when you, and some people have this capacity, and I'm sure there are people in the audience who have the capacity, which is, you know, if you can, they have a name for it now called lucid dreaming, you know, but if you can know you're dreaming when you're dreaming, then you may have more capacity to be not deluded. But I don't have much of that capacity, so I know that I'm psychotic still. I suppose you're into, you know, I'd start with the idea of paradigm, you know, that what was it in Alice in Wonderland? You know, they decided that, you know, instead of making a map that was an inch to the mile, they would make a map that was a mile to the mile. And I suppose I'm interested in that idea of maps, and I'm one of those wandering mad professors, you know, who can never find anything. You know, but because I can never find anything, I'm actually very good at helping other people find things. And I always say to them, you know, they say, I've lost my glasses. And I said, they're in your mind. They're hidden in your mind. You have to find where they are. And then you have to help the person track back. And they'll say, you know, my daughter, she always loses her phone constantly. And she said, I phoned her up. I was away out of the country and somebody had found Dad in her phone and phoned me. And I rang her up and I said, you know, where did you last have your phone? And of course she had an illusion about where she last had her phone. She didn't have a real understanding. So in a sense, I suppose this idea of paradigm, and I don't know if people know the work of Thomas Kuhn, who's very interested in this idea of paradigm, but paradigm is that idea that really we, and some of us are more deluded than others, and I think if you're an intellectual like I am, I'm even more deluded. Because it's like I continually miss the map and the territory. I work off a map all the time. You know, I went to the loo in my socks last night and walked on water in the in the loo area, you know, because I wasn't paying attention. So because my map had told me there wasn't water on the floor, but it was an improper map. And in a sense, I suppose one of my interests in some of the people I've worked with and some of my teachers is about when do you know your map is wrong? When do you know your map? So the map, in a way, is not the territory. But in a sense, it gives you some sort of idea. It's sort of like, I suppose it's a symbol. It symbolizes something that is beyond a mere map. At its deeper and most profound level, of course, it has deep meaning. And it is almost the thing or whatever. But at more grosser levels of delusion, it's sort of misunderstood, you know. So I think I'm being a good Buddhist, you know, and I reassure myself with that. I think that's like, you know, that's that story about the Good Samaritan that Jesus Christ told, you know, the one about where the, you know, guy passes by because he's on his way to the temple, he's in a hurry, but he's missed the point. So it's like that, but at the same time, yet there is some sort of sense of inner journey, and I suppose the inner journey, to my mind, if I was to look at it from a Buddhist perspective, you could say that there's a journey there's a sense of a journey, because I can't really discern the subtle until I've been able to let go a little bit more of the gross. And I think in a way the addict is a good example of that. That me as addict, as addicted to ideas, as addicted to whatever I'm caught up in, that until I can let go and practice letting go and non-attachment, that I can't actually get close to what I'm looking for because I can't enter. And I think, I sometimes think it's like that it's like in those concentric circles, that is the mandala or the maze to the inner self, that it's like I can't enter a layer. I'm excluded, and I'm not excluded other than by myself. But because I haven't the capacity to let go enough, I'm excluded. Yeah, I suppose in the Buddhist path, you know, which is the one I'm most familiar with, I mean, I suppose the here and now is a great place. You know, because in the here and now, there's no problem. In that instant of the here and now. But of course, it's gone in an instant and we're distracted. And, you know, I suppose that in Buddhism, we start with that idea, the idea of mindfulness, which is really about reminding about the present, about being present. And if I can be truly present, I might actually even understand I don't really need that square of chocolate that I think I have to have over there. But of course also, and this is where, you know, in Buddhism it's quite interesting because we talk about that, you know, that like the ego or the false self when you have a moment of mindfulness, it immediately creates a photocopy of the moment of mindfulness, sort of paste it up on the wall, and you sort of, you fixate on that, and you say, oh, I was mindful. But you're already lost, because you've lost the next moment. And in Buddhism, they teach that that level, what we call it, you know, for a want of word, because it's beyond words, it's not, it doesn't matter whether you call it, to my mind, it doesn't matter whether you call it God or whatever. I mean, it's more the sense of, it's the ephemeral, beyond. So if we're trying to work with what's beyond, that somehow in Buddhism they have that idea that we are the beyond. You know, we are it, thou art that, maybe in Hindu or whatever. But that wakes us. It's that wakes us, that we have a moment of wakefulness, you know. And, you know, I'm reminded of one of my teachers, Trungpa, when, you know, he say when you know, you're lifting the glass and the mat falls with it, you're woken up. You're woken up into the moment. So I think in Buddhism, the Buddha, by the way, just means awake. He who is awake. And that's all. That just. So I suppose there are many methods for waking. Waking up. For awakening. And I think there's awakening to the other as well, isn't there? Because our tendency is to be self-absorbed. And there's awakening to the other, to compassion, to inclusiveness. And of course, this is interesting, because I think in Buddhism they talk quite a bit about, you know, they get that idea that if we were truly, truly awake, if we're enlightened, if we're a saint, it doesn't matter what tradition you're calling it, that if you're that, then you have profound benefit for all. So sometimes I think we practice, you know, it's like a toy soldier, you know, it's like playing toy soldiers when you're a child or whatever it is, or playing Wendy House or whatever. We play the game because that's where we're going. We're a child of that tradition. And as a child of that tradition, you play with the things that are of that tradition. So I can play at being non-attached. I can play at being generous. I can play at being compassionate. I can play at being mindful. But I'm actually only playing. But it is, at the same time, it's play that does lead in the right direction. So I don't know. I mean, that's... But the mindfulness piece seems, that moment... Mantra cuts through the inner sense of attachment. Many methods. In its simplest form, it's a repetition of a sound, often having a meaning of the inner or the... In Buddhism, the mantra has the meaning of also protector or mind protector, protecting, sort of bringing one centered more into the inner.